Testing 1, 2, 3. Okay, I'm on tape, and how about you, Walter?
Hello. Here I am. I am Walter McInnes, age 76, born December 19. Can I keep going?
Yes, please.
Born December 19, 1931, in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. My parents was Bertha Hazel Andrew and Walter McInnes. I was raised in Colchester, Ontario, which was a village-type community, not too far from Windsor, and there was a mixed, many mixed immigrants in that area, nationalities and immigrants on the farm and working in the factories. And I went to public school in the little village, and I went to the local high school in the small town. And I don't know how to account for my coming to Alaska. Finally, I came to Alaska in 1949 as a sailor aboard a cruise ship to Southeast Alaska, made two trips, and then went back and then worked in British Columbia that whole year, and the following year went back east to go to school.
And where did you go to school?
Central Technical College, Central Technical School, Toronto, Canada. And so through the 50s, I basically was following a trade and busy in Canada, and then in 19...
If I can interrupt, what was the trade?
Radio operator.
Uh-huh.
And I was in the Canadian Arctic. Actually, Arctic and the subarctic for a total of 3 years altogether.
What were you doing there?
I was an operator.
And what kind of projects were you doing?
We were building defense warning, radar defense systems.
What was that like?
Well, it was. We were there in the construction phase, and it was isolated. It was a limited amount of people. The situation of contracts and work and what we were doing and what we worked with is, to me, so extremely different than the people that worked in the North Slope in Alaska. We started out with very small amount of facilities, and then we went to work and had a camp built, and we had built our own facilities. And then we went to work and built the base for the radar sites. And then once it got the basic base and building got built, then the technicians would come in. And after the technicians had installed equipment, then the Air Force personnel would come in and operate it. And about that time, we would be turning things over, and then we would leave.
What was the name of the radar system?
Well, there was two systems. I worked actually on two different systems. One was the Mid-Canada system, and the other one was distant early warning. And I also worked at a large... airport, Goose Bay Airport, which is a large SAC base at the time, Strategic Air Command.
What kind of radio did you have?
Oh, we had, well, we had the best you could buy at the time. And we had transmitters, a couple of transmitters, and about four main receivers, and then a couple of other smaller receivers for aircraft and things like that.
Thank you. Occasionally I'm going to jump in and interrupt you just to go off on a little direction Okay. Every once in a while. So, okay, so 1950s, you're a radio operator, and then somehow you got to Alaska and became a citizen.
My parents, my mother and stepfather came in 1959 with a group called the 59ers. They came from Detroit, Michigan, to Alaska, and they came in February and March actually in February. And I came for a two-week visit to cheer them up and tell them it was such a short, well, it was no big distance, in September of 59. And I'm still here.
And were, so they came directly to Soldovia when
they... No, they were up by Talkeetna.
Uh-huh.
In fact, somebody started a little museum there on the Petersville Road, and in that museum they have pictures of my mother and stepfather and the people who were part of that group at the time, and they have some photographs from that. And they incorporated that into the Petersville Talkeetna history. So that's probably available in various places.
Mm-hmm. But you must have very shortly come to Soldovia.
I came to Soldovia in the summers. I came in the fall of 59, and in the summer of 60, I decided I wanted to make some income for the homestead, and I decided I wanted to go fishing. And so I was looking. I checked the Seward first, and then I checked Kenai. Very little was happening at that time. It was a little early in the season. I checked Homer, and I was inquiring around, and I was en route to Kodiak because I knew Kodiak was a strong fishing port, and I had a water background. And so as I was in Homer, I was advised by a couple of people that I just talking and asking around, why don't you try Soldovia? So for $7.50, I got on a float plane and landed in Soldovia Bay. And as I was getting off the plane, I asked the pilot, where's a good place to look for a job? And he said, just stick your head in the bar. He says, that's where most of the action goes. So there was, it doesn't take long at that time. At that, in 1960, in all the 60s, there was more work in Soldovia than anybody needed or could handle. Everybody worked. This was a very active, work-oriented cannery, fishing, crab, salmon, and shrimp operations, plus a couple of hand-packed canneries.
When you got here then in 1960, can you describe the canneries that were here?
Well, the canneries and the town... everything was on sticks, and by that I mean it was a piling. All the canneries were on piling, and they were all off of the face of the beach or the bluff, and everything was built out over the water. And Soldovia itself had no flat spots in it. The waterfront curved along the rock cliffs, basically, and then when there wasn't rock, there would be short stretches of beaches. And so the canneries and the buildings and the hotel and the post office and different clusters of development would be along where the along the beach and along the waterfront, because the other was too rocky and not a good building site. And therefore the water and the sewer and the water and sewerage and everything, particularly the water, I don't think it was much sewage effort at that time, but the water lines had to follow the waterfront. And the boardwalk extended from one end of the waterfront to the other. The whole developed area had a boardwalk on it, and all the stores, the canneries, and all the activities, the little hotel, two hotels actually.
Do you remember their names?
The one was the Soldovia House. I think one was Soldovia House and one was the Soldovia Hotel, but that's as I recall. I kind of forget the, I know where they were on the map here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, on this picture, I can point them out.
Where were they on the map? And
well, right in here.
And how do we describe that for the tape? That would be...
It's in the section... Oh, boy. Because, see, this is a straight road out here now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Caps Hill right here. And this is the other hill that still exists in existence. But this was the big hill. And you know there's only one building on top. So the rock frontage, which was pretty steep opposite Cap Hill, and then heading along the boardwalk to the north, the hotel was was the first building in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a residence. And then there was a theater building, that's this one here. And then there was a bar, which was the Polar Bar. No, yeah, Polar Bar.
That's going south then, right?
Going south, uh-huh. North, going south.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and there were three bars in the time. There was the Polar Bar, the Linwood, which would be in here. And you can see that the distance between these two bars was about 75 feet, and the surf club. So this is surf club, and that's the Linwood.
What was the difference between the three bars? Did they have different clientele?
Basically, the Linwood and the surf were action, the guy's bar, and the Polar Bar was quieter off by itself, so you could go down there, and when things got a little too noisy or rowdy, Polar Bar was a quieter bar, and I had a pool table, but it was less fights and less rowdy.
Uh-huh. And we talk about Caps Hill. Why was there only one house on there?
Actually, I'm trying to see it here. There's another house. If this is a 59 photo, there should be a house right here.
Uh-huh, maybe in the shade or something there.
It's in the shade. It looks like you can just see the edge of it.
Who owned Caps Hill?
Collier owned it. Oh, that hill itself, I don't recall, but I know Mr. Backer, who had the surf club, had the house. He owned the little cabin on top. It wasn't very big. And you can see this little road that up here. And the kids used to ski down over in this area with was where they learned to ski and sled and everything right down through there, through the south facing. And as you can see on how the road is so much different here, you know, this is where the street right here, and see how it had this curve and another curve here. And this part right here is, I said the two trailers were. Yeah, we're right over here. But this part here where there was no trailers, I know that it must have been the very next year that they put a trailer in.
Hmm.
Because if not the first year I was here, within the second or third year was a couple of trailers in this. One trailer here and then later one trailer here. And that's the back side of Caps Hill.
What about churches when you first got here?
There was two churches. There was the one down way down on the end, which still exists, Bible Chapel, and then there was a Methodist church coming around the corner. There it is. That would be it, right here on this. I'll use the
back end. I can see where you're pointing.
Yeah,
that's right about. That's just to the north of the fuel company, wouldn't it be?
Yeah, actually, right now there's a point of land there, and there's a building up on this point. And the Methodist Church, it's either this one or this one, but there was a steep stairway, and this is all part of the old store complex here. No, wait a minute, yeah, it is. This is the store. And that's Surf Club, and that's Linwood.
And then there was the Russian Orthodox Church?
The Russian Orthodox Church is right up on top of the hill. It's just the photos. This is the Russian Orthodox this is the Methodist Church, and this is the hardware store. This is one of these is an apartment building, and then this is the hardware store here that belonged part of this store complex.
So most of the residential building was on land, is that right?
Yeah. the canneries and the bars, the surf club and the limit, all this was built over, all the main function of town was all built on piling. But, and this is the boardwalk, it almost, anything on the water side of the boardwalk was built on piling. So the boardwalk basically hung along the beach in the waterfront. And there again, you got this one pier here.
Did that have a name?
This pier?
Yeah.
No, it was just a dock. Or,
mm-hmm.
And, well, it was the city dock is this one right here. Now, that looks like an Alaska steamboat right there, a freighter from Alaska.
In this aerial photograph, which is, for the tape, we're looking at an August 15th, 1959 aerial photograph from Aerometric, and it's Seldovia Roll 59, Corps of Engineers 1, Exposure 3-4.
I'll be there. Now, I was here then. I have a very good chance I was down on this.
You're probably in there, Walter.
I have a very good chance.
Waving at the airplane.
Right here.
Yeah.
Unloading this boat.
Yeah. So you were, what's that called, longshoreman or something?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Stevedore works on the dock, and longshoremen work inside the boat.
Or
work in the slings, and that was longshoring. And at that time, it was amazing how quickly things changed, because 60, 61, 62, everything came by Alaska steam. And it was real shortly in that time period there where it switched to I'm trying to think, the vans that they shipped out of.
The containers.
Sea vans. And the container ships. And it shipped, and it was just during that time, as I said, the first couple of years I was here, there was at least two ships a year, sometimes three. The one in the spring would bring in besides bringing in cargo, it would bring in groceries and it would bring in the alcohol. And what was amazing, I helped unload that spring ship, and the alcohol, the beer and whiskey, there was the beer pile was equal to the grocery pile.
How high was it?
That was basically that was the main thing that the boat carried. There was some other freight, but their main freight was groceries and beer. A lot of beer. And but as I said, it was Sealand. Sealand was what it started to go into. And it was just a few years after that the Alaska Steam quit calling. But was part of the interesting thing was when this ship landed, and it was only two or three in the season, and when they were landed, well, they had, particularly in the spring, they had fresh vegetables, fruit and vegetables. And, of course, it was as fresh as after coming out of Seattle and being, so many days, and they had other ports to stop in before they got here. But all the ladies in town the women would ask you, when are you going to get to the groceries, and particularly when are you going to get to the fresh food, because it would be in there stacked and we'd have to unload it according to the way it was laid in.
And how long would it take to unload a Alaska steamship?
Well, the one time I worked there, I can remember working 52 hours straight. And that was loading. That wasn't unloading. That was loading. And we were loading salmon aboard that time. And so I would say at least for 3 days to load it. Unloading, I don't know. I would be guessing about two days. And It took longer to load the salmon because there were cases and they had to each be fitted in, and it was when Alaska Steam came in, then they weren't necessarily totally full. You know, they had stuff, I mean, full of stuff for Seldovia. They went to other ports. They went to Seward. They went to Kodiak and down the chain, depending on which route that boat had. So you could only take off the Seldovia things, the Seldovia groceries and beer. So that would, whatever length of time that would take. But I don't recall any real long stints, except when we did load in the fall, when we load up the salmon pack. And I said I worked 52 hours straight that one time. And it's actually two of us worked 52 hours, and the other guys didn't work that long. It's just so much you can do, so long.
And there were several canneries here at the time.
Yes, there was Alaska Year Round, which was a salmon cannery. And then in round 62, they built themselves a crab dock, I mean a crab cannery as well. And there was Wakefield Cannery, and there was Iverwent Shrimp Cannery, which later became Pacific Pearl. Hmm. And is still, the Pacific Pearl brand is still available on the grocery stores.
Mm-hmm.
But the Pacific Pearl was right down here, and Wakefield was here, and AYR was down here. That's this one here.
So going in, let's say, south to north, this one is Pacific, the first one going from south to north is Pacific Pearl?
Yeah, this is an old defunct one. This was cooking the Packers, and it, I think AYR was assimilated, so one company would buy out another. And this used to be cooking the Packers, but it was not a cannery when I got here. It was a warehouse and storage place. The operating cannery was Pacific Pearl right there, and it was almost a joint dock, and this was Wakefield. And we used to unload, that's a boat unloading crab right there. And the crab went right through this section. This was the processing section. This was like a warehouse part, and then over here was the shrimp area. The shrimp cannery area was in this area. And these things here are most likely barges for the where they had. See, this is just after they had the 59 was just after they had they used to have the nets from shore. What I'm trying to
think. Oh, fish traps.
Fish traps, yeah. And with the fish traps, they had barges for to load the fish on, and some people would have. With good fish sites, would have a barge to put their fish on. So I'm thinking that that's little barges, at least a couple of them there.
And so Pacific Pearl, then, I just thought of a way for to tell it on the tape. It was right straight out from Seldovia Street.
This is Seldovia Street right here. And actually, from the looks of this, Pacific Pearl, it was in between Seldovia Street and Lipke, which is now Lipke Lane.
Uh-huh. Very good. And then,
whereas Wakefield was right directly in front of Seldovia Street, the Wakefield Cannery.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then continuing north, we have what again?
Well, there was a restaurant, a part of the Linwood complex. There was a restaurant in here and the Linwood Bar. And then as I said, there was a space and the surf club. And this was basically the main middle of town. And then the hotel was, the main hotel, which got all the action, was, this is a rental, but this is this spot right here. And then this is cold storage over here. Wait, this is cold storage. This is all cold storage. And this should be the hotel right here. And this is a rental place. It's hard, this here, the photograph doesn't, for some reason, it doesn't do very good on that. That hotel had a breaks in it roof, and actually the hotel is this whole area, but you can't quite identify it real good.
Uh-huh.
But this rental thing here, that had a solid tin. It's funny how the roofs show a place better than certain roofs.
And then up here, where English Drive comes down, that's where the
that was the this was the fuel company was right here off this, and then the oil would unload, you know, and then pump the fuel up to these tanks, and so this was the right one. Jack English had his magistrate's office in here somewhere, and the post office was right over here.
Continuing north, and that would be about,
yeah.
Well, that's still English, near English Drive would be about where the post office would be. Yeah.
And I'm trying to recall this house here. This house here is still here, this one here, and this one here. This is here, and this is here. This is gone. All this is gone.
And so do these have names? How do you refer to that? One of them is the old hospital, right?
That's this one right here.
Okay. Did you remember it when it was a hospital?
No, yet I worked with people who were... I worked with a couple of guys who were born there from Homer. They worked for Homer Electric.
So what was it when you were there?
Grab that. It was still a hospital when I came, and continued to be the hospital up and through the 70s, I believe. 60s, 70s, early. I'm trying to... I don't recall exactly what date that they... it was sold to a private individual, but it was, I remember various doctors being in there. And Mr. Willard bought it somewhere in their late 70s, probably. And it's kind of interesting because now where we're going to go with the pipeline, and this is a good thing to look at this, is you look at, this is the work, no,
is this it? Is Alder Street here.
Yeah. And English Drive, Barnes, okay, basically, where Alder Street is now is a little different. See how this comes down here? And in this map, it jogs and goes over here, whereas now it goes directly right straight here. Alder Street now goes here, and you know where there's digging now is like out in here.
Mm-hmm.
You know where the road is out in here. I would say you can, with this map, you can figure the road comes real close to this hill point right here. This thing might forget that Sierra. That's on the water side of the boardwalk, but right
at Mission Street.
Yeah, but this and Mission or Church had never been anything. But the road now is one place where you can see where the road is right over where the old road was, is right in here. And then from here, actually it does follow pretty close along in here. But then I think over here, somewhere along here, it veers off over, like more over this way. But here's the interesting thing is that the road was here. This part here was not road, so that might be an area of interest to you.
Mm-hmm.
I had, in my mind, all of Alder Street was very inconsequential as far as finding stuff on a dig. It wouldn't be my place where I'd look. And if you're looking around, you get looking around and you find some... There's a photo of this area before the hospital was put in. Am I too loud? This area here, and in the 30s or so, there was a few little native homes up in... Right, this is the spot where they were, right in through here.
On the old church lot?
On this hillside.
Which, above it, because the church lot's pretty big. It's this triangular thing here.
Yeah. Basically, and right even some below it, Anyway, this is a good evening sunspot, and they were all, I recall about three or four of them being real close in here, in this area. So there might be underneath the fill somewhere, you know, in here there might be some people put through, because people used to bury a lot of their stuff in the backyard. You know, there was the only dump at that time when I got here. Let's see. Oh boy, isn't that interesting. Right here, that was the dump.
Where Winifred Avenue and Anderson kind of come together there?
Yeah, and actually, the present road is more like over here.
Uh-huh.
It comes to this point the same, but if you go over there, you'll see where the old road is in here, and the new road is out. They put fill across here and straightened it out, but the old dump was right here. Right in this spot, it was the old dump. And then, as I said...
What's there now?
There's that got knocked down, and I'm trying to think. This is a school up here now. This is the new school. And this is... it's been filled in over top by... when they pumped the harbor up. I'm trying to think what year they pumped the harbor out, but the part of the harbor was dredged once, and that's quite a few years ago now because it's rebuilt up at the mouth of the harbor. But the harbor was dredged, and all the dredgings was put up in here
to cover the dump.
Well, it was just that place was a lowlands like this, and it was just a non-committed piece of property, which I forget whether the city owned part of it and the school board owned part of it, but at any rate, they put it in there. And it's amazing that stuff has become pretty solid. When it was first put in there, it was a kind of monkey, and it drained out and settled and settled and settled. And you walk in there now, and it's like it's pretty good footing. It's nothing soft about it. And that's at presently you'll see that this right in this area here is a city storage yard, and across over here you'll see there's four engines under white plastic, which would take him out of the Homer Electric when they took down the old building and the old engines. And this is Homer Electric here, and there's another thing there. At that particular time, that's only about half the length of the building I eventually worked in. And because at that time, I think
what
he only had two
that?
Engines. This area right here. Charlie Merrill, Soldovia Power. And he had only two engines in there. And later on, HEA added two more. And actually, eventually, I think they added three. One, two, yeah. The engines came from Homer. And I can't remember exactly which year that happened, in 68 or something, that Homer Electric purchased Soldovia Power and started putting in, we had the, it was 66 they were building, 1966 they were building the they were clearing the right-of-way for the power line from Homer. I remember that. So it was either in the fall of 66 or in 67 when the power line came in from Homer. And maybe even later before it finally totally got built, because actually for years, I got to remember this. We ran the... I worked in the Soldovia Power Plant in Rosita. And Willard came here in 72, and this still wasn't connected. So even though they cleared right away in 66, it wasn't connected until sometime in the early 70s. And that's probably in some of these books somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask, the earthquake, of course, is like the big benchmark here in as far as time goes.
Right.
So you were here about 4 years before the earthquake.
Happened. I was here let's see, 64. So I was here 60, 61, 62, and 63.
And so if you had to compare pre-earthquake Soldovia and post-earthquake Soldovia, what was pre-earthquake Soldovia like in general?
It was more unique. It was very unique. It was very water-oriented. It was very, the people were all fishermen, cannery workers, native, Scandinavians, It was a very coastal water-related community. It was kind of funny. The people, as a transport, would use a skiff to haul stuff around, even to haul groceries and things. And there was very few motorized vehicles in Sildova. Even amongst people who had a fair amount of money and well-being in comparison. Their money went into improving their boats at that time. And after urban renewal, well, they flatly knocked Cap's Hill down, and they added all along, they straightened, added the waterfront, straightened it out a lot, and the roads were straighter, and actually roads got in. Prior to the earthquake, there was very few places that you could actually drive a vehicle comfortably in town. On the boardwalk, it was kind of like an intrusion, because what they had a trailer that hauled carts for the groceries to take stuff to the grocery store or to haul supplies around. And the only person that had an old Willys four-wheel drive as an oil delivery, and then he had another one that she used for garbage when they did start to have a garbage service. And that was Mr. Wrestler, Kenny Wrestler, and he had the, what do they call it, Sildovia Cartage, Sildovia something or other. If you lay one beside the other in comparison of the amount of vehicles and the people, how they use the vehicles now, and how many vehicles there are per family. And at that time, there was only two or three vehicles in the whole town, you know, regular type vehicles. There was the fire department had a couple of Jeeps, and the grocery store thing had a tractor that hauled stuff, you know, that's how they got their supplies from the warehouse, and the dock and warehouse was all tractor and little trailers. And the boardwalk, I think it was about 8 feet wide, but you know, when you'd come to a corner, even today, what little section of the boardwalk is left, people don't drive vehicles on it very often because it doesn't accommodate vehicles. And this section right down here gives you a good example. But as I said, there was two or three vehicles. I bought a vehicle here in 1962, and I had one. There was only three vehicles running at that time. You know, people actually get in the car and run. I mean, there was the fire department had a vehicle, Jeeps. The oil delivery had two Willys, four-wheel drive. There was a taxi here in the early 1960s, but they had these little Anglias. I think they called them Anglias. It's small cars. Might not a Crosby, but they're smaller version, a smaller version of cars that you could get at that time. Let me use a cough drop.
Sure.
Okay. Back on tape.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. I do have a question though. What kind of vehicle did you bring up?
I had a Ford six cylinder station wagon. I bought it in Long Beach. 1962. I had made a good season, and so I gave myself a vacation. I went back up north to Homestead, and then in the middle of winter, I gave myself a vacation. And I went down to Long Beach, and then I went to Mexico. And while I was there, I bought a station wagon. And then I drove it back up. I left it in Homer 1 year, so I actually was 63 before I brought it over here, 63 or 64. 63 probably, because I think I was here before the earthquake. And as I said, at that time there was only about three running vehicles in town. So then after the earthquake and things, they started putting, you know, the dimensions of roadways changed and the transportation changed. And it's like you look at this here and you see all this was undeveloped. You know, this section here later became the lodge and had houses all built through here. And the new school is up in this area. And all this area, a road was built across here. Young Street was built down right through here and then down across here. And if you look at this, everything is not mostly all along the waterfront except Willow Street and Catchimat Drive up the slough. And then over on this side, I'm sorry.
Sure. Can I do something for you? You want more water or?
I'll just take another couple. Maybe this will start working.
Yeah. Tissues?
It's just my throat. It's raw. Take a break.
Okay, so we're back on tape. And you were saying that you missed the earthquake here because you were in Nenana.
I was in Nenana, and I was previously, when we were on the homestead, it seemed to be frequent shakes. And when the big one hit up at Nenana, it didn't seem that much, except it lasted so much longer. It didn't crack the road, and it did shake some things off of some shelves, but it didn't do really major damage in Nenana. However, unbeknownst to me, my parents had come up from the lower 48 where they had been visiting and were staying in Fifth Avenue apartments in Anchorage. My stepfather was in front of the city hall when the earthquake hit, and it knocked him down. And so he grabbed a hold of, as he was knocked down, he looked up, and the flagpole, which has this big brown globe on it, was moving like a fishing pole. It's extreme, one back and forth, like just like a fishing pole being cast. And he grabbed a hold of the parking meter and pulled himself to his feet, holding onto the parking meter for one purpose. He said he knew it was the end of the world, and he thought he might as well watch it. Instead of just laying there, it's going to be the end of the world, and he was going to watch it. As soon as he got on his feet, the part of 4th Avenue that dropped, I don't know, it was 18 or 20 feet or 15 in part, but different, 15, 20, I imagine, is what I recall. But it, right in front of his eyes, just a short distance away, a long section of the opposite side of 4th Avenue just sunk. And like I said, he said, "We're just the end of the world," and he knew it. And my mother, in the meantime, was in the bathtub, and she tried to get out, and couldn't, made a couple attempts, and then actually hurt her head pretty hard. So she decided that she wasn't going to be able to get out of the bathtub during the actual time of the quake, which lasted fairly long. And so she just stayed there until the quake was over. At that time, there was Anchorage was growing, and there were some new businesses and things, and they had some young ladies come up to be clerks and typists and work in the business community, and they were staying in that same motel apartments. And they were so frightened with the aftershocks. My parents, as with me, we weren't much frightened by the aftershocks because we had experienced them on the homestead at Talkeetna. And to my folks, it didn't seem to bother them, but the people who had recently come to Anchorage, the young people from the lower 48, it so scared them that they'd come and knocked on the door and wanted to spend the night on the couch with my parents. Place, because they were afraid to be alone. And 2 weeks after, even a strong aftershock, and the next morning the two of them came and said goodbye to my parents, because they were leaving Alaska. They were still 2 weeks later, they were so afraid, so scared about the experience that they'd had. And
I knew quite a few people. One fellow I knew that used to play band, and he had two children, and he picked up his children. He lived not too far from downtown, and picked up his children and ran outside, and it wasn't until the shake was over that he did realize, and this was in March, he realized he didn't have any clothes on. But he got out of the house. He was, you know, afraid to stay in the house. So that was the some of the earthquake stuff that I know of. Other things would just be repeating other people's stories.
So then, how long did it take you to get back to Seldovia after the earthquake?
I'm trying to recall. It was in March. I don't think I came down here to the late spring, and then there were signs up, and people were taking a petition to get urban renewal in. And so
it was several months.
Yeah,
many months.
It was a few months before, a couple of months. I think maybe 2 months before, maybe 1 or 2 months before I got down. Maybe 1 month.